Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and WETS-HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, James Madison did lots of important things back in the day, but as today's guest is going to point out, his ultimate objective wasn't just putting together a government. His ultimate objective wasn't just getting that government up and running. His ultimate objective was really to build an informed, free citizenry, a citizenry that would actually live out the constitutional values that he'd put into our most important document. And that was a lifelong project. In fact, it's a project that we hope that we're doing it, we're carrying on today, both on this radio show and, of course, out at the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. And that's, in fact, where I was when I spoke to today's guest. His name is David Marion. And I spoke to David a month or so ago, right before he was going to teach one of those wonderful residential seminars at Montpelier. This particular one was on the Bill of Rights. And David and I sat down, and he gave me a preview of what he was going to do the next day. And our conversation just ranged all over the subject of civic education. In fact, one of the first things we did was talk about single-sex education, because, you see, David is from Hampton Sidney College here in Virginia, which is one of the oldest, I believe maybe the very oldest, all-male institution still operating, institution of higher education still operating in the United States. Here's David Marion.
Well, I'm one of the old fogies at Hampton Sidney College, the oldest remaining all-male institution of higher education in the United States, founded in 1775.
Right.
And it so happens that James Madison, as well as Patrick Henry, were on the early board of the college. And so we have that connection with Montpelier. Mm-hmm. I've been there for 37 years, teach courses in constitutional law and American government. And it has been a delight working with the young men of Hampton Sidney all those decades.
Well, you know, I know that our focus is going to be on what you're teaching here this weekend and on the Constitution. But of course, when you mention Hampton Sidney and the fact that it's all male, I just have to ask generally, what do you see as the role of all male education and higher education now? What are the advantages or disadvantages?
I think actually the case for all male education is getting stronger all the time. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's unfortunate that it's getting stronger. It's getting stronger because young men in the United States are really in crisis. When you look at what is going on with 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20-year-old young men, the number of them going to college compared to young women, for example, most co-ed institutions have a divide today somewhere around 60-40 women-men. Mm-hmm. Women now are outnumbering men in law schools, in med schools. They're hungry to move forward and to succeed. Young men are more likely to fail out, to have learning disabilities, to have problems while in college. And so I think that the country finally is waking up to the fact that as several decades ago, it looked at what was going on with women, and we began to invest resources to help move them forward. I think that's been a fairly successful movement. I think now it's time to turn our attention, a little more attention to young men, to see if we can help them to find themselves, develop the skills, and acquire the knowledge that they're going to need to be competitive with women, and to make the kind of contribution that we're going to need to have them make for this country to be the country that we want it to be.
That's really interesting you should say that. I've noticed those ratios as well. We seem to be getting a mirror image of what we had 30, 40, 50 years ago. I know when I went into law school, we were still talking about getting our female numbers up.
That's right.
And now they've surpassed the male numbers, and now we're going in the opposite direction, and we've got an issue there. And you think that single-sex education helps in that regard?
Well, I think that single-sex colleges can make a contribution. We've been in the business of educating only men for over 200 years. I think we know something about
okay.
how to do that. And we can help others in that way. I think it is the case that for some young men, going to an institution that specializes in the education of young men would be beneficial to them. Just this one fact. If a young man enrolls at Hampden, Sydney, all of the leadership positions on campus are available to him, and the chances are, before he graduates, he's going to hold some type of leadership position. If he enrolls at a co-ed institution where women, this is understandable and in fact should be applauded, women want those leadership positions today because they want to move into leadership positions after the college.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're competing for those leadership positions, and they're going to get their share of them. And so the likelihood that a young man going to a UVA, a William & Mary, or any other co-ed institution is going to have the same shot at holding a leadership position and getting that extra training that comes from having that sort of an opportunity compared to what we're making available at Hampden, Sydney, or at any other single-sex education for men. That opportunity is going to be less at a co-ed college than at a college that only takes men.
Very interesting. 20, 30 years ago, I would hear very similar arguments made in favor of all-female institutions.
That's right.
Like Holyoke and like Smith.
That's right.
At Wellesley. Very interesting. Well, that was a brief digression, slightly off the constitutional path, but I simply couldn't let it pass since it's so unusual for me to speak with a scholar from an all-male institution. So thank you for sharing that with us. And I guess it's worth noting, interestingly enough, that not only do you all go back 200 years, but all of our higher educational institutions at the time of the founding and for many years after were
right.
all-male institutions.
Right.
So maybe there's a bit of insight to be gained from your experience there in our founding generations. All right, now let's get back to the Constitution. What do you teach at Hampden, Sydney?
I teach courses in constitutional law, both powers and rights, and besides that, courses in general American government, public administration, public policy. I do some budgeting, some administrative law. When you're at a small liberal arts college, you got to be a jack of all trades.
Same thing at a small law school.
I'll bet. And so I'm not specializing in the way that somebody teaching at a major state university like the University of Virginia or George Mason University is able to specialize.
Right. Yeah, I understand you completely in that regard. Well, so you have a wide range of experience in both American history, American constitutional history, constitutional law, all very relevant to what we do here at the Center for the Constitution and on our radio show. Why are you here today?
I am here to kick off a weekend program for high school teachers that will focus on Madison's Bill of Rights. Madison is understood to be by most students today, I hope, to be the father of the American Constitution. That's a title that came to him early on. What we don't often acknowledge often as we should and as fully as we should, is that Madison really is the father of the Bill of Rights as well.
Mm-hmm.
We really owe him credit for pushing Congress in the summer of 1789 to work on the Bill of Rights to get into that task. Congress, a little reluctantly at the beginning, finally did produce amendments that went to the states for ratification. So we're going to be looking at Madison's work on behalf of the Bill of Rights.
And a little bit of background. He was somewhat of a late convert to the idea of a Bill of Rights, but this was the fulfillment of a promise that was made during the ratification process. Right.
That's exactly the case. Madison was of the opinion that if we were going to be effective in protecting the rights of the American people, then we needed to shape our constitutional system, the system of government and the society that we created, in a way that would enable us to see that those rights would be protected as a matter of the functioning of the system. He was not somebody who believed that what he called parchment barriers, a mere declaration on paper that the government should not invade freedom of speech, should not invade freedom of the press, should not invade freedom of religion or deny a right to a jury trial or to counsel, would be really sufficient to protect rights. If you were serious about protecting rights, then you needed a system of government. And you needed a society that was shaped, that was crafted, that was organized in a way that would provide real protection for rights. And so when the subject came up at the Constitutional Convention, late at the convention, Madison was one of the delegates who was not eager to get into a Bill of Rights. That for a number of reasons. He felt that it was important that the convention wrap up its business. The business that it had been about through the summer of 1787, drafting a constitution for a federalistic system with a national government, a real national government. He worried that the debate on a Bill of Rights could endanger all that they had accomplished over the course of the summer. He felt that the American people were growing impatient and wanted to know what it was that the convention was producing.
In secret.
And he wasn't convinced that merely putting down on paper that the government would be prohibited from invading certain rights would, in fact, effectively protect those rights. So he repeatedly said to his friend Thomas Jefferson, for example, and others, that he was not convinced that we needed to add a Bill of Rights to the Constitution to achieve what it is that he wanted to achieve. He did note, though, as his conversation with Jefferson evolved over time, that he was never fully opposed to a Bill of Rights, so long as it was done properly and so long as it did not undermine the type of government that he felt would be needed in order to have the kind of democratic republic that he wanted. Long-winded response.
Although, no. And you've told me some things that are slightly different from what I've heard in the past and have further enlightened me. And so that was very helpful. But during ratification, a lot of people, including his buddy Jefferson, and certainly people like Patrick Henry, people like George Mason, started making waves. And they were the anti-federalists, by and large, and that was their primary argument. And the most effective argument against this new Constitution was there's no Bill of Rights. So partly as a political compromise, Madison and company, the Federalists, said, okay, you ratify this Constitution the way it is, and then the first order of business in the first Congress is a Bill of Rights.
That's right. That we will join you, the anti-Federalists, in working on a Bill of Rights to safeguard those liberties that you believe may not be adequately safeguarded by the Constitution in its current form. Jefferson was on board for a Bill of Rights from the get-go.
Oh, yeah.
And George Mason, another Virginian, eager to have the convention. Mason was at the convention, work on a Bill of Rights. He did not succeed there. But again, another strong advocate for a Bill of Rights. This became, as you noted, a major obstacle for the Federalists or the Nationalists during the ratification debates. And so a compromise was entered into, ratify now and we'll amend later. And that's exactly what happened.
And that's kind of where you're picking up then.
That's right.
And that's the interesting thing is that Madison, once he made this promise, he was determined he was going to fulfill the promise, whereas a lot of other Federalists said, that was just election talk. Let's do other things.
That's right. Madison was as good as his word and, in fact, felt that the new government had to be in order to earn the respect of the American people. Madison understood that to make this experiment, and it really was something of an experiment in democratic republicanism work. Nationalists, the advocates of this new system, had to bring the American people along. They needed the support of the American people. If the new national government could not secure the support of the American people, then it was unlikely that this experiment was going to succeed. And if it failed, then for Madison and others like him, all bets then were off in terms of what would happen. They saw where we were headed under the Articles of Confederation, a mere confederal system, where the states held on to their sovereignty. It did not appear as if anything good was going to come of the direction in which we were going in under the Articles. And certainly Madison did not feel that he was going to be able to secure for the American people the kind of society and the way of life that he believed that we had wanted for ourselves at the time of the Declaration of Independence and during the Revolutionary War. We had declared our independence. We had gone to war with Great Britain because we wanted a certain kind of society for ourselves. We wanted a certain way of life for ourselves. And Madison wanted a constitutional system that would meet those objectives, that would meet those ends, that would get us what it is that he thought we wanted at the time of the Declaration. He did not believe that an American federal system, that a system based on state sovereignty would do that. And incidentally, if I might add this point as well, that in part explains his reservations about a Bill of Rights. Madison understood that to get us where he wanted us to be, he had to have, among other things, a competent government, a government that was equal to the exigencies of governance, mm-hmm. The requirements, if you will, of governance. The government of the Articles, the central government, at least under the Articles, was not up to doing what it was that we needed that government to do. The American people were already rights-oriented. I think Madison in part feared that a Bill of Rights could accentuate that rights orientation and could make the American people a little ungovernable or a little more ungovernable than they might otherwise be, and that would be a difficulty. You need a people that will restrain itself and understand that it has to allow the government to do certain things. And so if you go too far, I think Madison felt, in the direction of accentuating rights, when you already have a rights-oriented people, you can sort of move in the direction of anarchy.
Yep.
Which is a real problem, and the problem that he talks about in Federalist 10 when he says, hey, you want a good democratic republic, a defensible democratic republic, you better be able to deal with this problem of factious impulses and factious violence.
Very interesting. So despite these reservations, though, eventually Madison comes around. He makes the promise at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, and unlike many of his Federalist compatriots, he decides he's going to honor it. He comes to the first Congress, and he says, hey, guys, we got to do this. And in fact, he goes, and he collects all the suggestions that the various ratifying states have made. Now, they ratified, but many of them said, and we suggest this and this and this.
That's right.
And then he went through a process of culling out the ones that he felt were good or bad, mm-hmm. and coming up with a set of proposals. Now, how many proposals did he have at the beginning? I think it was something like 16 or 17.
That's right. And 12 will make it through Congress.
By the two-thirds majority.
That's right.
And they get sent to the states.
They get sent to the states. And ultimately, of course, 10 will get ratified. And they become what we call the Bill of Rights.
And by a coincidence that a lot of people don't recognize, the last necessary state to ratify is Virginia.
This
is like the center of the constitutional universe. Every time you look for something, it all happened here. Not all of it. I mean, all due respect to all the other founders from the other states, or many of them. But, man, whenever anything really important had to happen, it tended to happen right here in Virginia.
It is the case. The Constitution has Virginia written all over it.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Marion of Hampton-Sydney College, and he's talking about how important it is that we educate people about the Constitution, and in fact, that's what he does every day, both at Hampton-Sydney and occasionally at the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. We've been talking specifically about the Bill of Rights and Madison's role in that. And after the break and after a quiz, we'll come back and talk some more about those things with Professor David Marion. Stick around.
Some people think we don't have the right to say it's my country. Before they give in,
they'd rather fuss and fight
than say it's my country. I paid 300 years or more of slave driving sweat and welts on my back. This is my
Well, it's that time again, my favorite time of the show, when Kelly Carmichael comes into the studio, at least via Skype, and tells us what the constitutional quiz question is going to be this week. So how are you, Kelly?
I am great.
Tremendous. As always, you're great. What's our question this week? Well, wait a second. Oh, wait a second. Wait. Who's our contestant this week?
Yeah, we need to know who that is. I'm just ready to ask the question.
We have to have a contestant. Who's our contestant?
Speaking with Joe from Tallahassee, Florida.
Tallahassee, Florida. Are you a Seminole, Joe?
I am.
You are. Will you do the chant?
Oh. How about that?
That was lame. That was really lame. You had to start out higher. You were too low. Right?
Something like that.
What do you mean something like that? I'm a Seminole by marriage. I had to learn that as an adult, so I deserve more credit than that. But yes, indeed, that and the tomahawk chalk and the chop and the the Seminole tradition. That's very interesting because the Seminoles are very much a part of the Florida State team, and they're very supportive of Florida State's athletic program. It's a very nice partnership between the tribe and the school. So we're very happy to have you from Tallahassee. Are you ready for a tough question?
I am.
Tremendous. Kelly, you got one for him?
I do. All right, here we go. Women gained the right to vote. Was it A, because the framers decided they deserve it? B, after many decades of civil protest? C, if their grandmothers had the right to vote? Or D, when they became landowners?
Oh, I think I'm going to have to hear this one again.
Women gained the right to vote, A, because the framers decided they deserved it.
Okay.
B, after many decades of civil protests. C, if their grandmothers had the right to vote. Or D, when they became landowners.
Oh, those are all interesting answer choices. So I guess women have the right to vote, is that right?
I hope so.
I guess that's true. I think my wife.
Somebody who voted in the last election participated in it in quite a significant level. Yes.
Okay. Well, they got it somewhere along the line. So, Joe, you got to tell us, when did women and how did women get the right to vote?
Well, I don't think the framers considered giving women the right to vote. So I'm going to go ahead and toss A out, at least put A to the side.
Okay.
C, I believe, was women would have the right to vote because their grandmothers had the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
A grandmother clause.
Yeah, it just seems like it's one of those, which came first, the chicken or the egg type of things. I'm not sure.
Are you calling my grandmother a chicken or an egg?
No, I'm just not sure when your grandmother became a grandmother enough to pass along the right to vote.
Ah, okay.
So that seems to be there's a logical flaw in that one.
Okay.
But I'm just going to set that one to the side in case I need to go back to it. Landowners, I don't believe before the suffragist movement took place, women were permitted to own land.
Hmm.
So that leads me back to answer choice B, which would involve a substantial amount of years in which women protested and finally got the right to vote. So I'm going to go with B.
You know, I think Joe has been sandbagging us, Kelly. I think he knew the answer all along. He was just running through those options to make it suspenseful.
Well, I think Joe has probably listened to the show, and he knows that you're gonna require folks to go through all the answer choices anyway. So he was ready.
Yes, he was. And indeed, did he get it correct?
He did. Congratulations.
Congratulations, Joe. Yes, you are absolutely right, starting most notably with the Seneca Falls Convention. I think it was in the 1840s. And then spanning the next many decades up until 1920, women agitated and politicked and bothered their husbands and other people and insisted that they be treated as equals in society. And at least the first step toward that was to get the suffrage, to get the vote. And they finally got it in 1920. And we've devoted an entire two episodes to that subject. So you're exactly on. You're exactly right. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. You get a T-shirt.
Fantastic.
Are you going to give it to a woman?
You know what? That's not a bad idea.
It's not a bad idea, especially if you've got a honey, especially if you've got a sweetie pie, and you can say, this is your women's suffrage T-shirt.
I like that idea.
Very good. All right, Joe.
You know, Stuart, my husband's birthday is coming up. Maybe I need to give him a T-shirt as well.
Maybe you do. We'll have to bring one to you next time out at Montpelier, which won't be long now.
Yes.
Joe, thanks very much for playing. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you so much.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Marion of Hampton-Sydney College in Virginia. And we're talking all about the importance of civic education, of continuing James Madison's work of not just building a constitution, but building an informed, free citizenry. When we left off before the break, we were talking about David's upcoming seminar at Montpelier, where he was going to talk to a group of teachers about James Madison's involvement drafting the Bill of Rights.
Interestingly, one of the amendments that Madison did not get, and an amendment that, in fact, he said was he thought the most important of them all, and it tells us something about what Madison was up to, his project, and what he thought would be required in order for us to be organized in a way to bring about the ends that he wanted for us and that he thought we wanted for ourselves as well. He had an amendment that would have applied to the states, and it would have prohibited the states, for example, from regulating the press or interfering with rights of conscience, or we would say today, freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. He did not get that amendment. And so later in the 1830s, when John Marshall, still on the Supreme Court, gets a case out of Baltimore having to do with whether the states are bound by the Bill of Rights, Marshall will say, you know, if you look at the evidence, it appears as if there was no intention to bind the states by the Bill of Rights. And so
Barron versus Baltimore, big case.
That's right. Up until we get into a process called the incorporation process post the addition of the 14th Amendment, the general understanding is the First Amendment applies to the federal government and not the states, the Second Amendment, Third Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, that all these amendments restricted federal action but not state action. But Madison would have restricted the states from doing certain things, and you know, as he indicates as well in Federalist Paper 10, when he looked around, he thought the potential for maladministration and for threats to particular rights was greater at the level of the states than would perhaps be the case with the federal government, and certainly the early federal government. And when Madison is looking at the federal government, he is looking at a federal government that is limited in its powers, a government of delegated and enumerated powers. So he just did not see that that government was going to be as much of a threat as the states might be to some significant rights. But he doesn't get that amendment.
And as with so many things, he was right. He saw very clearly what the circumstance was, and so what many people forget today is that we actually had several states at that time and subsequent to the adoption of the Constitution that had official state religions, and we had many, many infringements of things like freedom of speech, notably in many of the states of the South right before the Civil War, when they basically outlawed any discussion of abolition or slavery at all, any criticism of slavery. And so there were lots and lots of freedoms that we take for granted now that no government can take from us, But the states were actually free to trample on those freedoms right up until the early 20th century when, bit by bit, the Supreme Court started applying those same freedoms to state governments
right.
as it did this. And that gets lost in the history.
It took the 14th Amendment, which applies directly to state action, to effect that change. But even then, it took several decades for it really... to make a difference. It was, in fact, into the 1920s before
right.
the Supreme Court says, oh, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of the press, that applies, those rights protected by the First Amendment, that applies to the states as well.
Gitlow. Right.
In the Gitlow case of 1925, that's right.
Very interesting. Now, we've talked about a lot of very interesting things, but believe it or not, my original intention when I decided I'd like to have you on the show was so that you could tell me very specifically what you're going to cover tomorrow at this class. Now, have we started down that road, or have I interrupted you so many times?
Well, we have identified some of the things that we're going to be covering this weekend. We actually are going to begin tomorrow morning by framing out the discussion of the Bill of Rights by first looking at the roots of ideas and principles of law that had a significant impact on the founding generation and principles and doctrines that are reflected in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So we're actually going to begin with a discussion of Locke and limited government and separation of powers and checks and balances and Montesquieu and the independent judiciary. While it is the case that leading founders like Madison deserve a great deal of praise for what it is that they did for us, it's important to understand as well that they were not the originators of many of the very important principles and doctrines that are reflected in our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They didn't come up with the idea of an independent judiciary. They didn't come up with the idea of a bicameral legislature. They didn't come up with the principle of due process of law. Those principles, those doctrines were kicking around. They were part of the American culture at the time of the Declaration and the Revolution. What Madison did and Hamilton working with him and James Wilson and Benjamin Franklin and other leading founders, what they did was that they took these principles and these doctrines and they packaged them so very effectively so that more than 200 years after the framing of the Constitution, after the drafting of the Constitution, we're still benefiting from that constitutional system. But it's the way in which they package them, not their invention of them, that sets them apart. So we're going to begin there, and then we're going to move to the Federalist, Anti-Federalist debate so that the teachers have this background information to work with before we jump into Madison, Madison's political thought, Madison's Constitution, and Madison's Bill of Rights.
Very good. And are these going to be middle school teachers or high school teachers, or what level are they going to be?
We generally have... a mix of teachers who are here, mostly middle school and high school teachers, and mostly high school teachers, but there'll be a mix of teachers here.
Right, and this will deepen their knowledge and give them lots more understanding of the background and the fonts of these sort of ideas.
That's right.
And they can then take them back to their classrooms.
That's right. That's the intention, to run this something like a graduate seminar so that we deepen their understanding of Madison's constitutional system, Madison's Bill of Rights, Madison's America,
mm-hmm.
So that they then can go into the classroom and provide their students with, we hope, a very thoughtful explanation of what was going on at the founding, and also a defense of the relevance of the study of all of this, so that they'll be able to answer the question, why are we studying what was going on over 200 years ago? Why do we need to study
all these
what was
dead
happening
white
in 1787
yeah.
or what Congress was doing when it was debating the Bill of Rights or what was going on in the ratifying conventions? so that they can answer the relevancy question.
I am so pleased by everything that you're talking about, and I'm so pleased to hear you talk about the relevance and importance of this. And in order to illustrate this, all I have to say to you is something perhaps you've read about in the papers recently, and that is Rowan County, North Carolina. The county commissioners of which recently passed a resolution that purported to nullify the First Amendment in their state, and then had several of their legislators introduce legislation in the North Carolina legislature nullifying the First Amendment in their state so that they could then proceed to establish a state religion. I'm not kidding. I mean, this is what these people actually proposed, and one wonders whether this is purely a matter of ignorance, if they have no idea what these things say and why they're important and why nullification is not a possibility and why the First Amendment is the supreme law of the land and why the First Amendment... I mean, yeah. The questions are infinite, but they all go back, in my mind, to thinking these people just never really studied this stuff. And they don't understand it.
Well, I agree that we have not been on top of our game the way that we needed to be on top of the game so that... the American people really do understand what it is that we're looking to do for them through this constitutional system and what they're getting out of it. And the pieces that are required in order for us to deliver on, you know, the promises we had made with the Declaration of Independence, because we had made certain promises that this was going to be a country dedicated to certain principles, that we were going to promote the safety and happiness of the people. That's what we were going to be about. Well, those are ends. What are the means? And the means are complicated, and we have not done a good job of clarifying the end for the American people, or the relationship of the means to the end. What's the relationship of the First Amendment to that end? What's the relationship of having a certain kind of Senate, a certain kind of House of Representatives, an independent judiciary to that end? What is the relationship of the single executive to that particular end? What's the relationship of a right to counsel, a right to jury trial, a provision with regard to the banning of cruel and unusual punishments, a banning illegal searches and seizures? Mm-hmm. Those are all means to a particular end, and we've not done a good job of helping them understand how all the dots are connected.
We've not, David.
And if they understood that, then they might see, gee, you know what? I have reservations about X, but I now understand how X is related to this thing that I really like and want for myself and my children and my grandchildren. So I'm going to be more inclined to go along with that,
or at least not
whatever
try to throw
it might
it
be.
Out.
That's right.
Exactly. You know,
right.
We often hear about the inadequacies of American education, especially when it comes to the so-called STEM fields, science, technology, math, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And hey, I'm with you on that. You know, I have a kid who went to Caltech. I mean, the STEM is great, and math is great, and quantitative stuff is great. But you know what? It's just as important that we understand our own constitutional heritage. I mean, we call it the American experiment, because the result is open-ended, and it could fail at any moment, and it will fail if
right.
we don't teach our children what it is we're experimenting about.
You know, if we've learned anything from our intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, it should at least be this, that it is really tough to build a democratic civic culture.
Oh, yes.
And that good institutions alone, you can give the Iraqi people, the Afghan people, the best institutions, an ideally contrived parliament, an ideally contrived executive department, an ideally contrived judicial department. But if those institutions are not supported by a solid civic culture that is defined by a commitment to the values that you want those institutions to protect, then chances are you're not going to get what you want. You're not going to have the country that you want. The good institutions alone are not enough. So the question then becomes, okay, what does that civic culture have to look like? What kind of civic culture do we need in order to have the democratic republic that we want, in order to have the kind of America that we want? And how do you get that civic culture? Is the First Amendment part of that? Is the Fourth Amendment part of that? Is the Fifth Amendment part of that? And of course, are the institutional arrangements that we find in Article 1, Article 2, Article 3 of the Constitution, is they part of that as well? Is good judgment part of that? Are all bets off if we're not exercising good judgment? I would argue yes.
Yeah,
then a question
yeah.
becomes, how do you cultivate that? How do you cultivate good judgment on the part of legislators? How do you public officials? How do you cultivate good judgment on the part of voters? Voters need to understand this system and the relationship of the culture to the kind of society that you're going to have, what you're going to get from your America, so that they can be informed voters and can put into public office the kinds of people who will, in fact, protect the civic culture, who will promote the health and well-being of that civic culture. The voters need to know these things as well.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Marion of Hampton-Sydney College. And David was just about to teach a Montpelier seminar on the Bill of Rights and James Madison, and we've been talking about not just those things, but about civic education generally and how important it was both to Madison and to us today to engage and to develop an informed citizenry. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with David Marion, and then we'll have an update on the national finals of the We the People competition. There's some excitement for you, so stick around.
Number one, freedom of religion, speech, and press. Plus, you can assemble in crowds and protest. Number two, right to bear arms and cannons. I bet the Minutemen didn't know about handguns. Number three, when soldiers get sleepy, you don't have to let them sleep up on your couch. Number four, no one can search and seize. It protects me unless people have a warrant to arrest me. Number five, if you arrest me, respect me. Sorry, Alec, there's no double jeopardy. What'd you do at the school? I plead the fifth. What'd you do?
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's finish up our discussion with Professor David Marion of Hampton-Sydney College.
I'm so interested to hear you mention Iraq. Once again, Madison is correct. You can give them the best written constitution in the world based on all of our experience, new and improved, latest version.
That's right.
And
it can all look good on paper.
And it will be a parchment barrier if the people of Iraq or any country don't live up to it and don't implement and don't exercise proper judgment and have proper values. Two words, Weimar Republic. I mean, they had a constitution that was supposedly democratic, and they, if they didn't actually vote Hitler in, they at least allowed a Hitler to take over. Right now, Arab Spring, we had revolutions. Are those revolutions going to result in liberal democracies? It's not looking too good lately in most places that I read about in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And once again, you can have the best, you know, thinkers come together and put together a constitution, but if the people themselves are not going to be vigilant about their own liberties, if they're going to vote in a theocratic government or some sort of autocratic government, well then, great, you've got a wonderful document.
Mm-hmm.
The examples are limitless. The old Soviet constitution was pretty nifty, too.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a lot of freedom there. But I'll stop talking. All right, is that it? you've hit one of my biggest hobby horses here.
Well, you know, let me add in that connection, one of the things the teachers will be hearing from me this week is that Madison, the constitution builder, was in the business of building institutions. There's no doubt about that. He was involved in the debate over what Congress should look like and what powers it should have and so forth. What the judiciary should look like, what powers the judiciary should have. Those are institutions. But he was in the business of shaping citizens. Ultimately, finally, that's what this was all about. Madison was in the business of shaping people. In order to have the kind of country that he wanted, he needed a certain kind of people. And Madison was really in that regard a profound thinker. He knew that he had to be thinking about the institution stuff, the mean stuff, in light of the kind of people that he wanted to create.
So really, we're just carrying on his work here.
We hope so.
I mean, obviously, we hope so.
I tell the teachers, that they're helping to protect Madison's Republic, and they're continuing Madison's work. Every day in the classroom, they are continuing the work that Madison was doing. If I can slip this in as well.
Sure.
It is notable that almost all of the leading founders were directly involved in shaping public opinion. When you think about Franklin, the oldest delegate at the Constitutional Convention, and active at the Constitutional Convention, Franklin writes his autobiography. What's that all about? Franklin is looking to shape people. Washington's farewell address. He's shaping public opinion. He's shaping a citizenry. Madison, in his various publications, from Federalist Paper 10 and Federalist Paper 51, to even his response to the Alien and Sedition Acts, Madison is shaping public opinion. He's in that business, and he's got his 2 feet in that business. Marshall, writing a biography of Washington. What the heck is he doing writing a biography of Washington? Well, he clearly admired Washington, but Marshall was hoping that biography would get into schoolhouses, into classrooms. He wanted to shape American public opinion as well, shape citizens as well, through this particular publication. And you see, I mean, Jefferson doing it. You see all the leading founders doing
it. And that's why we have to read what they wrote, and we have to study what they did, because they have a lot to teach us. Now, getting back to tomorrow, you've done this before, haven't you, here at Montpelier?
I've been coming back and forth, making the trip between Hampden, Sydney, and Montpelier for many years. In fact, I was on the ground floor here. I was here working with the staff at the time of the bicentennial of the Constitution.
Wow, and back in 1987.
That's right. Back in the 1980s, and we drafted a proposal to the National Endowment for the Humanities. Well, you know, I started out saying I'm one of the old fogies from Hampden-Sydney College. I've been there almost 4 decades. So I was here in the 80s, and we worked on an NEH proposal to be able to bring teachers here. I then started hosting some high school teacher workshops here using the facilities at Montpelier before they had their beautiful Constitution Center. So Hampden-Sydney College was up here offering workshops for high school teachers. And then when they got off the ground with the Center for Civic Education and the programs, their own programs for high school teachers, they kindly invited me to come back. And I've been coming back now for
beautiful facilities. Oh, lovely facilities. And, of course, that gives plenty of opportunity for interactions outside the classroom. Now, I'm going to ask you, does that actually happen? Do people leave the classroom? Do the discussions continue?
The discussions absolutely continue. They continue over meals. They continue outside. They continue in the houses.
You're staying right here.
I am staying on site. That's right. I'm going to be here with the teachers. I'm going to be available to them. And generally, the conversations are either about you know, something that we've gone over in a session, something, a remark that I've made, something that I've covered, and they're looking for clarification, this is very common as well. The conversations have to do with figuring out how to make this intelligible to their students.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how can we take this in the classroom? Can you help us sort of think that one through a little bit? How would you take Federalist 10 in the classroom? How would you take, you know, the debates on the Bill of Rights into the classroom? You know, how would you get a 14, 15, 16-year-old to sit up and pay attention and take notice? And so sort of practical application questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're sitting here in Lewis Hall, and we're sitting in the very classroom where you'll be teaching tomorrow, I assume.
That's right. Yes, we're going to be
here. And it's a lovely facility with whiteboards everywhere and ideas and all the rest of it. A bust of Madison watching over us. On the other side of Lewis Hall is the dining hall, and this will be my last question. They're staying here for several days.
Yes.
How's the food?
Oh, the food is excellent. they spoil us. They generally... Have local restaurants catering, or often that is the case, and the food on every occasion has just been excellent, and so no complaints there.
All right. Well, thank you very much, David. We very much appreciate your time, and one of these days I'm going to come and I'm going to sit down in one of your classes.
Well, I invite you to come to Hampden, Sydney, and you know, occasionally we send a student over to your law school.
Oh, okay.
So you have seen some of our boys.
And they do very well with us, and we'll be happy with as many as you can send us. Thanks, David.
All right. Well,
Bye.
Thank you.
Professor David Marion, Hampden, Sydney College.
And now it's time for just a little change of pace, but it's on basically the same subject, the subject of making good citizens, of making free citizens. And one of the best programs for this one that's near and dear to my heart, you've heard me talk about it before, called We the People, and I'm pleased to say that I just got back from the national finals, the 2013 national finals of We the People, and I'll give you the results in just a minute. But before we do that, let's start with some interviews with the team that the Quiz Lady and I know the best, the team from Virginia. Here's a brief discussion with their coach, Rob Peck.
I'm Rob Peck. I teach at Douglas Freeman High School in Henrico County, Virginia, and we're here for the national competition of the We the People program. And
so that means you are the champions.
We are the Virginia State champions this year, which is a big honor for us. We're delighted to be here. We've had a good first day yesterday, did really well. I've used a baseball metaphor to describe it to some of the parents who weren't here. We had a couple of home runs and a couple of doubles and a couple of base hits, so we're in the game, but everybody got on base yesterday. So if you can have that kind of batting average, I feel pretty good about it.
Well, that's what my old baseball coaches used to tell me, just get on base.
That's exactly right.
The rest of it, take care of itself.
Take care of itself, so I feel pretty good about it. We worked... much of last night and much of this morning sort of refining things that we knew we could improve on. So I'm excited for today.
Were there any real curveballs yesterday?
There was. There were a couple. One of the questions for Unit 2, which is the unit that's on the Constitution itself and Constitutional Convention, and the question was about the sort of lasting impact of the anti-federalist debates. And the line of questioning went pretty aggressively towards representation and modern understanding of representation. Well, certainly a part of the anti-federalist discussion, it wasn't really central to it. And we kind of felt like we'd sort of solved the question of representation in substantial ways. And representation hasn't changed too much in the last 100 years, but it's very much what the judges wanted to talk about. So,
right. So they picked an obscure part of an obscure topic and asked you obscure questions.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, that happens.
And the group did fine with it, but you know, they were. We had thrown some bait out to the judges, just asking them to ask us about some more what we thought were more interesting questions. But you know, you roll with it, and that's just kind of how the conversation goes. Let's see, other curveballs. The curveballs I'm expecting today,
I'm expecting
the judges to want to talk in detail about drones. I imagine that there might be some discussion of federal government and its control of financial institutions and stepping in through Dodd-Frank, bound to be... privacy rights discussions and terrorism and the authority of the executive to do whatever he sees necessary to keep us safe. So I'm assuming that those will come, and then I'll be surprised when they don't. But the kids are very ready for those conversations. We're really excited. It's just, you know, whatever happens today, we've been delighted to be here. It's just been a great experience.
It is a fantastic experience, isn't it? And you're absolutely right. It's such an honor to be here that, you know, even if you don't advance, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Not that I'm predicting that. In fact, I'll go out on a limb and say I will be surprised if you do not advance. Because I saw you all at the state level, and man, what a team.
Thank you very much. They've worked really hard. One of the judges yesterday said something really nice and basically said what you just said, and he looked forward to having a conversation with us in the finals, and we're looking forward to that as well. So I hope we get there. I hope for them that they get there because they've worked really hard. But even if we don't, they can absolutely hold their heads high. We did well.
Thanks, Coach.
You bet.
Did you notice something? Did you notice that the high school here was Douglas Freeman? They're a very nice team. I spoke with a number of the kids. I judged them at the state level. Had a great time with them. Here's a brief discussion with one of their moms.
My name is Corey McDonald.
Hi, Corey McDonald. And you have a kid in We the People here in Virginia?
Yes, sir.
Tremendous.
Yes,
well,
sir.
Who's your kid?
Ian McDonald, and he's from Douglas Freeman High School.
Right, which is the number one team in Virginia this
year.
And
it's wonderful.
And has Ian had a good experience this year?
It has been wonderful. Mr. Peck, his teacher and his coach is just phenomenal, and they've learned so much, and I'm just so proud of them.
Tremendous. Anything in particular stand out in terms of memories? Anything in particular he learned that was new to you, or
well,
any comments he made?
The Constitution part is wonderful, of course, but also just how to work with the group and how they tag team and just work and how it flows from one student to another is just a nice.
Yeah, those are all good skills
to
learn, aren't they? I read someplace once that people are more afraid of public speaking than they are of death. And this involves getting out there and speaking with people and cooperating with people and working together as a team in a stressful situation. So, yeah, those are good skills.
And also just knowing that your answer might, as long as you can back up your answer, you know, that you can disagree with your classmate or whatever, but as long as you can support your findings.
Well, here comes the team.
Yay!
So I'm gonna let you go.
Thank you so much.
And the team did very well. They won an award. It's one of the regional awards. It's given out for the best high school from that particular region. And, of course, Virginia's in the southeastern region. Let's hear the announcement.
And so we wanted to recognize each of the regions in these five who did the best overall on those first 2 days. Region 4 of the southeastern states. And the winner of the Region 4 award, Virginia.
Wasn't that great? I'm just so very proud of our Virginia team from Douglas Freeman High School. The very first time at We the People National Finals, and they got that regional award for the Southeast. I'm sorry to say they did not advance to the top 10, but hey, you know, you can't do everything your very first year out. But a number of other wonderful schools did advance, and in fact, the competition was, as always, extremely tough. Just for the record, let's see who was in the top three. I believe it was Denver East High School of Denver, Colorado, was in third place. They were an extremely tough team, and in fact, I think they were sort of the favorites going in to win everything. At least that was the scuttlebutt around We the People this year. The second place finish was Amador Valley High School of Pleasanton, California. Extremely good team. And the very top team for this year was from Grant High School of Portland, Oregon. And they were just extraordinary. Everyone was talking about their final round and how well they did. So congratulations to the teams from Oregon, to the team from California, and finally from Colorado. And that's about it for today. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are part, an important part, of the American experiment.
Hi, this is Wayne Winkler, executive producer of Your Weekly Constitutional, here to tell you that we'll soon be launching another show, Your Daily Constitutional, a 90-second daily summary of current and historical issues in constitutional law. Your Daily Constitutional will soon be available on many public radio stations and on iTunes. Please join us for a daily constitutional update.